Anywhere and anytime, Semper Fi. You lay it all on the line, Semper Fi. Yeah, we live until we die, until we die. Always faithful, Semper Fi.
Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, BBG. Whenever you hear that song, Semper Fi, by Kurt Stacey, you know we've got a Marine coming up. Thanks so much to Kirk for providing that song to American Warrior Radio. You can hear more of his stuff. Visit KurtStacey.com, KurtStacey.com. The Iraq city of Ramadi lies 68 miles west of Baghdad and is the capital of the Al-Anbar province. It is home to approximately 375,000 souls, the majority of whom are Sunni Arabs. Holding a strategic location along the Euphrates River and the road to Syria and Jordan, it's a city that's seen its share of battle from both world wars to the present day. In the words of Major General James Mattis, if Ramadi fell, the whole province goes to hell. So Americans fought in Ramadi in the spring of 2004. They continued to fight in Ramadi on up through 2006. From 2014 to 2016, most recently, Iraqi forces had to fight to release Ramadi from the grip of ISIS. Now, that's my perspective from 30,000 feet. Today, we're going to bring that view down to 30 feet, or maybe even 3 feet, and focus on the battles that took place between 2006 and 2007. For months, 250 Marines of Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines engaged in daily battles in and around Ramadi. Scott Husing led and fought alongside those Marines. He compiled the stories of these battles and the Marines who fought them and the families back home who did their part as well. His book, Echo in Ramadi, was recently released and is being greeted with great and wide acclaim. Now, I want to add my kudos to that crowd of acclaim for the book. It's a good book, but I got to tell you, Echo in Ramadi is different than many of the books about war and combat that I've read. I can't say I enjoyed the book in the traditional sense. But that's what makes this book special. I can say I was compelled by what was on those pages and left better informed after reading it. There's something about this book that one quite can't put a label to, and so we've invited the author to join us here on American War Radio to share his perspective. Welcome to American War Radio, Major Scott Husing, United States Marine Corps retired.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show, Ben. It's great to be here. And my perspective was about 5 feet, 11 inches. Exactly, I think at the time. So.
Well, and I wasn't kidding about that. I guess, you know, you probably...
I was 3 feet tall.
So no, I'm sorry.
Average size Marine.
I probably should have said maybe 3 meters off the muzzle of the barrel. How's that? Does that sound better?
There you go.
Well, Scott, honestly, with all due respect, I didn't mean... Readers, listen, get this book, Echo in Ramadi. A portion of the proceeds go to benefit programs that help warriors who are dealing with some of the issues after combat. But it's a great read, but it was different than anything I read before. So I meant no disrespect by that, but I'm really looking forward to our chat today.
Yeah, I think you and I have spoke a little bit before the show, and I think you really – put your finger on it, and that's an important message that I like to share with listeners and readers of Echo in Ramadi, because it is a different book. It's not a traditional war story because of the fact that it's about the people. It's about the feeling and the emotion and what these young men and women went through during some of the most difficult periods of fighting. And it's about the families that supported us while we fought, and that still continue to support us to this day. Our amazing Gold Star families have always been there for us, and mm-hmm. they continue to, you know, carry this torch for so many people that are still kind of trying to find their way through their own darkness. And it's just an amazing network. So it's really a story about the power of human connection, I think, is what came across after the 75 interviews I did with my Marines, soldiers, and families.
Well, I tell you, Scott, let's establish your bona fides right off the bat. I tell you, you're a busy guy. Every time I'm on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere, Scott Husing is on a different radio show, a different TV show, on some kind of blog. I suppose, just like you trained to go into combat, that probably already built you up and trained you to come on American Warrior Radio, huh? You had to go through Fox and CNN to get here?
I did probably about 70 interviews in the last month after we launched on Fox and Friends. But, you know, I want to say this, is that I'm very grateful to people like you, Ben, and shows like this that allow me to, one, share the story, but two, provide a medium so that these great military stories about our real life heroes do not get marginalized in mainstream media, because I think it's a vital message. And it's interesting. I was talking to a close friend of mine, is, you know, Americans will go out and spend $40-$50 on a movie to watch actors play these war heroes, but we've got our own. And yet our mainstream media won't carve out a 6-8 minute segment and highlight the heroics of those that are still fighting today, those that are still in Iraq, still in Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa, and all the other places that we take care of our nation's business. And I think that's an important message, is that they're out there. So your show and so many others that have supported me over the, since we launched the book on February 20th, have just been a real blessing to me, because it's a great opportunity to share the story.
Well, Scott, and I look forward to sharing more of that, because again, our show, a lot of our listeners, the mission of the program is to educate civilians like myself, who, you know, we make the decisions to send you and your fellow Marines and everyone else off to war, and so therefore we need to understand the realities and the ramifications of that. And your book, Echo and Ramadi, is just, wow, a perfect way to do that. So, real quick, before our next break, you had 24 years in the Marines. Scott, you retired as a major?
That's correct. I enlisted right out of high school after having a not so stellar high school career. And, then after seeing the error of my ways, realized the value of a college education, then got my commission and, retired in December of 2013.
And what other than to pay for college, what inspired you to become a Marine?
Well, I led a very high risk lifestyle even as a young kid, you know, and I ran from the cops and raced my motorcycle, fought a lot, you know, a lot of underage drinking. There's not a lot of supervision, Ben. And when I was introduced to the Marines, there were this bigger than life group of, you know, risk takers. And I was like, these guys are a perfect fit for me. You know, and so I enlisted, and, you know, I learned so much during that first 4 years, you know, as I fought in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and was given the discipline and, you know, education of how to grow up and that regimented lifestyle that I think me and a lot of other Marines seek out, in that tight knit family, organization, that brotherhood is everything, and it's not just a bumper sticker. It is a lifelong bond. And I think you can see from the endorsements and people that have staked their 30-year careers and reputations on Echo and Ramadi, like Bing West and Oliver North and Dale Dye and so many other, you know, legends of the Marine Corps, like Major General James Livingston, Medal of Honor recipient, wrote the foreword for me. You know, they're a pretty scrutinous bunch, and, Marines are well known for eating their own for breakfast. You know, if I didn't get it right, they would have told me. That's one thing for sure.
Well, especially Dale Dye. I mean, he's all about accuracy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
There you go, folks. This is your host, BBG. We're joined live by Scott Husing. He's the author of Echo and Ramadi. You can find out more. Visit echoandramadi.com. Stick around with Scott when we come back. You led a company of Marines in Ramadi, street to street, house to house. Let's come back. When we come back, let's start off by sort of framing the context of what you and your fellow Marines went through. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by Scott Husing. Scott is the author of Echo and Ramadi, 24 years in the United States Marine Corps. He retired as a major. Scott, give us one of the most powerful things about this book. Like I said, it led me to a better understanding, not only of what you and your fellow Marines and all of those who serve go through, but also the importance of context. Describe Ramadi for us, the broken Ramadi. I mean, physically, you know, in your book you say all these buildings are all shot up. They look like Swiss cheese. The streets are not so clean. I'll leave it at that because it's a family show. So give us a context of what you and your Marines went into in 2006.
Well, to paint a picture to the listeners, I think any image that they could imagine of a post-apocalyptic nightmare that was just obliterated or scenes from, Road Warrior. It's just the place was just literally chewed alive by years and years of fighting. And we'd been in that city for several years, slugging it out with a well-trained insurgent force. And, you know, that was a key point for us in 2006 is that we went back, and what we did in Iraq really did turn the tide in that city. But to put it in context, it really was a two-year battle, and we talked about this a little bit because it started in 2004 when 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines was there alone and unafraid in the city, and then we went back in 2006 to retake the city because we handed it back over to the Iraqis who didn't have the infrastructure, the political system, or the military to provide security in that city. And what was remarkable to me as well was I had about 50 Marines that fought in Ramadi in 2004 with my company. And they all told me it's gotten so much worse. They couldn't describe how bad the fighting was in 2006 compared to 2004. And they had some significant fighting in 2004, don't get me wrong. But we were fighting day in, day out, sometimes, you know, 5, 6, 7 times a day in direct contact with insurgent forces. And we were doing it in concert with our Army brothers and Marine battalions that were to our left and right and north and south. And the city was just boiling over. I mean, literally into the burners with the gas on high. And there was just really no rhyme or reason. But this was part of the surge strategy in 2006 that General Petraeus and President George W. Bush ordered to really hammer down the insurgency in every single city like Fallujah and Ramadi and Baghdad. Because up until that point, we've been playing this giant game of whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd hammer them down in a little bit, crush the enemy into fine powder in most cases, and they'd seep out. And then they'd pop back up in another city where we didn't have a strong presence. So that's how the battle went for two years. And, you know, those conditions and challenges and the determination that my Marines had to fight under some of the most unimaginable conditions were really remarkable. And, you know, people ask, you know, did we win? I say, absolutely we won. We won that city. And our failure was only that we handed it back over to the Iraqis in 2007. And I think we just need to turn back our history dials to May of 2015 to understand that's where ISIS took hold.
Sure.
May of 2015 because of the fact that you identified it was the capital of Al-Anbar province, its key terrain, and they took it. So without the infrastructure in place, without having this physical presence and being good students of history like we were in World War II, in the Pacific theater, and in the European theater, establishing that presence, that's where we continue to find ourselves today, still fighting in that country.
Yeah, it's funny. Well, it's not funny, haha. But if you read history, you see how some things just don't change. I mean, perhaps we can get into this towards the end of the program. As you know, democracy is not a just add water sort of a formula. And you know, when we talk about the physical broken down infrastructure of Ramadi and some of the other cities of Iraq, there's also the governance infrastructure. And I think in your book you mentioned there were still laws, and police. But pretty much everybody ignored them. I mean, to much extent, it was a very lawless frontier, if I could use that word.
It was. It was absolutely. It was a world without rules and just chaos. And I think people had become so desensitized to that. It was really a surreal experience as we were fighting in the city and we'd amongst the people that lived there. And they'd be standing there as if it were some spectator sport, and we'd just take all of this in as we're fighting to try and win and survive on the battlefield. The locals had no input, and they'd become so desensitized to everything going around them. It was really remarkable to see that happen.
Very, very sad. Let's talk. There's some themes that I see run all the way through Echo and Ramadi, Scott. As a civilian, I appreciated it, and I want our listeners to appreciate what you called friction. And the word friction runs throughout the book. And one of the best examples, you're engaged, and your forward air controller had called for, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but he called for air support or an airstrike. You guys are out there mixing it up, and there's no aircraft overhead, and it came down to something as simple as time zones.
Yeah, I mean, my forward air controller, Rich Rasmussen's call sign was Bam Bam. You know, it was all of those things, that friction I describe in the book, and sometimes it's a complete paragraph, this indescribable pressure that was constantly around us where you don't have control over things, and your training and intuition have to be the things that you rely on sometimes the most to help you survive. And when things don't go your way, that's when you really feel that friction rubbing you in multiple directions to, push you in one way or another. But it was interesting as well to me is that, excuse me, the lens that I viewed it through as a 35-year-old commander on how I dealt with those pivotal moments of friction were vastly different than those of the 18 and 20-year-old men that I led in the streets of Ramadi. And it probably took writing the book and some years of wisdom and experience, as you know, to gain an understanding that the things I was asking them to do, these superhuman acts in the face of great danger, they never let me down. And these guys took care of each other better than anything I'd ever experienced. And they took care of me too, Ben, which is why I'm able to be here talking to you today. And that's why it's such an honor for me to be able to share their story, because it's not just my story. It's really theirs. And although the characters in the book in Echo and Ramadi are individual people, I think that they're very emblematic of what all soldiers and what all Marines and what all families deal with during war.
Now, I tell you, Scott, again, as a civilian, because you mentioned the movies and the heroes in the movies, the warriors in the movies, and generally everything works. You can fire a 22-pound machine gun, single-handedly with both hands, and you never run out of ammo, all those things. But, in your book, it really emphasized that, comms don't always work. And sometimes you're maybe only a couple alleys apart from each other, but you can't see each other. You can't talk to each other. Another perfect example, you're going into clearing out house, you're looking for insurgents, you're looking for the insurgents' weapons, and you're on a foot patrol, and I say, okay, you go in, you get the weapons, yay, job is done. But, sometimes, so your Marines are carrying their equipment, their weapon, and now they got to slog along with two or three other AK-47s and ammunition and stuff. I mean, it's those little things that we don't think about that contribute to the fog and the stress of war and the friction.
Yeah, it was something that most people don't really grasp, and I try to capture that and really relate it into terms that people will understand, is how physically exhausting it is to be operating under those conditions that are so dynamic, so fluid, with the uncertainty that they're surrounded by day in and day out. And again, it's I never boast that we were the biggest, baddest company of Marines ever walk the face of the battlefield, Ben, because there were plenty of other units that lost more Marines, that suffered equally, if not more, than we did, and that fought as hard, if not harder, than we did. But we had this remarkable chemistry in Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines. And, sometimes people read it and they'll either think I was extremely unlucky or maybe a little clumsy as I describe how our actions are on the battlefield, and even some of mine, because it's not this smooth, fluid laser beams scanning the target area and kicking in doors with precision and zapping bad guys like it's depicted in Hollywood. It's rough. It's dirty. It's a horrific, life-changing event for most that experience it. And that's what I felt was important to describe in Echo and Ramadi to the readers, because I wanted it to be unvarnished. but I also wanted it to be presented in a way that was not graphic or, you know, with some over-exaggerations of what combat is and what it isn't, because there are parts of the book that are also kind of humorous, where the Marines are surviving and fighting under the worst conditions, yet still finding the levity of it all as they take care of each other. And it's these highs and lows in the story that make it really interesting.
I tell you, one thing that sort of made me smile, and it was probably funny in retrospect, but there's a Marine who took I think it was a pen flare out of his pocket and accidentally lit the thing off into your cantina where there was some cooking oil around and resulted in a fire, which was, I guess at the point was a bad thing, but maybe looking back on it, it's like, okay, did he get a nickname after that?
I'm quite sure he got a nickname and probably a good whitewashing from our company first sergeant, Tom Foster, for that act of, absent-mindedness, so to speak. But yeah, it could have turned disastrous really quick, because the cooking oil that lit on fire, as you could read, was also the same place where we stored all the ammunition down on the first deck of our firm base.
Oh, man. I'm going to get you into some safety training sometime, Scott. We'll talk about that. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by Scott Husing. Scott is a Marine, 24 years of experience. He's got a very, very compelling book out, Echo and Ramadi. You can find it at echoandramadi.com. I encourage you to read it. You can find this interview and over 150 others with our warriors and our sheepdogs. Visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Scott Husing. Want to talk about rules of engagement, Scott, when we come back. Stick around, folks. Scott, what do you think of that, huh? A little classic for you.
Motivating.
You going to make that your theme song? That's Rex Allen, Arizona's very own singing cowboy.
Nice.
You don't want to know what the movie was about. It was about guys on shore leave, and it didn't probably reflect. Well, it was right for the time, I guess. We'll leave it at that. Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by Scott Husing. Scott is a Marine with 24 years of experience, I think 10 deployments, Scott, to 60 different places on the planet?
Over the course of my career, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And he's got a great book out called Echo and Ramadi. I really encourage you to read it. It's a very different kind of book, folks, so I encourage you to get your hands on it. You can visit echoandramadi.com. Scott, one of the other underlying themes in the book, but also then you dedicate a particular chapter to this situation that you call the mosques, the rules of engagement, you describe how surreal it was. Your Marines are engaged in a firefight. The citizens themselves are kind of streaming out to watch this like it's, you know, Sunday evening entertainment or something. You know, on occasion, people get hurt. You don't know. In fact, you describe in the book very often the reason you're looking for the weapons is the bad guys would force some of the residents to store weapons in their home. They'd grab it, fire a couple rounds downrange at you, put it back, you know, then walk on whistling down the street like nothing was wrong. In fact, you cite a particular situation where you went into a home, an elderly woman had an AK there with a fully loaded magazine, and when you asked her, she said, well, it's mine. And so you asked her to put the magazine in the weapon, show me how to use it. She had no idea. And so it was pretty clear, at least to me, that the bad guys were forcing her to store that weapon. And in particular, tell us about your little adventure with the mosque. I say mosque singular, but it ended up being three mosques.
Well, it was extremely challenging to fight in a city like that amongst the people, where the front line was literally everywhere as we fought street to street, house to house. And we would encounter situations where we combed through houses and we'd run across people that had weapons, because that's the way the insurgents fought in an asymmetric war. Is every single house that they went in, they'd hide and stash weapons, and they'd intimidate the local populace and basically tell them, you know, imagine someone coming into your house saying, Ben, keep this weapon for me. If you don't, or you tell anybody where you got it, we're going to come back can kill you and your children. And that's the type of fear and intimidation that was pervasive throughout that city as they pushed their hateful ideology across to try and support their caliphate to you know, fight the coalition forces. But one of the tactics they also used was to use the mosques and these holy shrines as safe havens to not only store weapons, but bomb-making material. They used them as planning centers, and they were all off limits to U.S. forces. And it was a very, very rare occurrence where we would ever get green-lighted to go in and raid a mosque. And there was a situation where we had actionable information that came from one of our interpreters that said that they had been stockpiling all the weapons at the mosques in the city. And the commander at the time made the call to allow us to go ahead and raid the mosques, and it proved great results because we pulled out piles and piles of weapons.
Scott, let me interrupt you. That's not quite, you know, Dale Dyer would be angry if I didn't correct you here. You had permission to raid one mosque, sir, and you decided to raid a couple more, which, despite the pucker factor afterwards, you that was the right decision.
Well, yeah, we had several patrols out that night in key areas in the city, and they were in close proximity to two other mosques. So I made the call on the spot to raid all three mosques, and we raided them simultaneously for the most shock effect. And again, it was with great results, and we had a unfortunate incident with a civilian casualty on one of the sites, and I went back to the command center and talked to my boss about it. And, you know, like anything, you can't sugarcoat a situation like that. And when I explained the details to him of what happened that night, I was extremely happy to find out that he supported my decision. And like most commanders, you take responsibility for everything you do or fail to do. And that night he didn't, you know, react harshly. He understood my decision-making process and supported me on it. And I think the tactical gain on the ground based off of where I was, he understood that, having been at my level at one point in his career as well.
You know, one of the other things that you mentioned, this book is not, well, it's about the war, but it's about the people. It's about your Marines. It's about their families. It's about your brotherhood. It's about the citizens of Iraq. And to me, one of the more compelling stories of this entire action over there has been what you call the TERPs, the translators. You know, these are men, I'm guessing, in most cases, who volunteered. They're putting their lives at risk before, during, and after their service as a volunteer. One of the most compelling interviews I've ever had was with an Afghan interpreter who we are finally able to get to the United States. He was in hiding for 3 years. And they're killing his friends. They're threatening his family. So you dedicate quite a bit to the interpreters there. I think Big Sam was at the one of them.
One of them, just remarkable citizen patriots of Iraq that are really emblematic of their loyalty to their country and the fact that they want security and safety for their families. Because up until that point, again, these are young kids, 18, 19 years old. And they made a commitment and the sacrifice to join the coalition forces and really help us out speak the language, because without their help, we wouldn't have been able to do it. And two of them to this day, Big Sam and Ford, are both U.S. citizens. And we got them over here, and they're, you know, just doing amazing things. They are the epitome of what a success story is. And there were females that went out there as well. And one female interpreter that we had was extremely vital, and she, you know, stayed up with the Marines on patrol just like the best of them, and was just remarkable. We're very fortunate to have these brave young men and women with us, because we didn't speak the language, and without their help, we wouldn't have been as effective as we were on the battlefield fighting day in and day out.
And, you know, it's important for people to realize, too, and you really get this from the book, the clearing part of the surge. I mean, you're going into people's homes. You're establishing a base, maybe, of operations for the night. You're searching for weapons. And you make it very clear in the book that in most cases, even if they're friendly, just your presence is putting them at risk. So I think in most cases, Scott, you said, look, if you got family here, you might want to go stay with them. But you make a very solid point. Imagine any of us as Americans, you know, someone barging in and doing that to us, and what a challenge it would be to deal with. And then if you add a language barrier to that, that could get messy real quick.
Well, we enjoy such great civil rights and protection from our first responders here in this country. I don't think anybody can imagine, other than watching a bad episode of Cops on TV, having your house stormed by a squad or a platoon of U.S. Marines and said, hey, Ben, hit the bricks, man. We're staying in your house, and I hope you got some family nearby because you're not staying here. Because if you do, it's going to look bad for you, as if you're helping out the Marines and if you're helping out the coalition. And normally we let them back in the next day, you know, throw them some cash for their inconvenience, and we continue to patrol throughout the night. But it just wasn't safe for them to be associated with us, because it as I write in Echo and Ramadi, there's no subtle way to hide an entire platoon or a couple of squads of Marines in a house. It just doesn't last. The secret doesn't last long. I mean, the insurgents that were blended in with the population soon found out where we were. And if we overstayed our welcome in any case, we'd wind up getting into a pretty good fight at whatever position we were at. So our normal procedure was, you know, we'd move in at dawn, we'd sleep over, provide security. And then as the next day came around in night cell, we'd take off and just comb through the rest of the city, because we operated almost exclusively at night because of our advanced thermal imaging and optics. We owned the night, and that's when we went out and hunted the bad guys.
And I tell you, Scott, it's interesting to me. Marines are very good at blowing stuff up and breaking things, and you know, your Marines were no exception. But I find it very interesting that you said sometimes, I mean, you're going from zero to 60 real fast if you hear a shot or you get a call with the radio. But one of the challenges was also in some of these areas getting your Marines to go from 60 to zero.
That's the best analogy I can use, because it is a real challenge as a commander to make the Marines and soldiers understand what the rules of engagement are and how different they are from city to city. And we traversed several different cities in Iraq during that deployment, from, you know, central Ramadi to western Ramadi, and then further west to western Al Anbar province in Rutba, Iraq. And those dynamics and the threat and the demographics of the city, that all changes. So the individual Marine has to change as well. And that's a very tough thing for a young Marine to do. And it's also a challenge for leadership to make them understand what we were able to do in this part of the city here is probably not going to be acceptable under the rules of engagement that went from extremely permissive to extremely restrictive in certain areas of the country. So again, it was based off of the atmospherics that we were dealing with in whatever area of the country we were working in.
Scott, I tell you, I'm really enjoying this conversation. Time's flying by, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by Scott Husing. Scott has just got a very compelling book out called Echo and Ramadi. You can find it at echoandramadi.com. Stick around. We'll be back for the last segment.
Well, I fly that plane, call the angel flight. Come on, brother, you're with me tonight. Between heaven and earth, you're never alone. On the angel flight, come on, brother, I'm taking you home.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Scott Husing. Scott is the author of just a great book called Echo and Ramadi. I encourage you to get it and to read it. Scott, I had to play that song. That's Angel Flight by Radney Foster. We actually had Mr. Foster on the program several years ago. He was inspired by Red River 44, which is a flight of 7 Texas National Guardsmen that were killed. And that's when he learned about angel flights, and I found it really wonderful, Scott, that you dedicated a chapter of your book to angel flights, which for our listeners that aren't aware, those are the flights that are tasked with bringing the remains of our fallen warriors home. And I found it interesting, Scott, you didn't know much about, let me back up a little bit. One thing I love about this book is you know your Marines. You introduce us to every single Marine that's in your book. We get to know them. We know what they did in high school. We know about them. And on the Angel Flight chapter, you talk about that, you know, you're focused on caring for your Marines while they're there, while they're in battle, and you knew they got home okay, if God forbid it came to it, but you didn't know much about it, so you took the time to explain to us what happens on an Angel Flight. And I wanted to thank you for that. I think that was really special.
Yeah, I thought it was an important story, and you come across these little nuggets of wisdom when you're doing all these interviews, and I thought it was very important, and I think especially to military readers when they read that chapter, because there's so many of us, and as I explained, even with the 15 plus years I had in the Marine Corps, I really didn't know what happened to our Marines and soldiers from the point of injury to where they were taken to mortuary affairs or to the treatment center. You just kind of had this blind faith that they'd be taken care of. And that, I don't say that there's no apathy in that. It's just that there's only so many classes you can get on, so many processes about what we do as war fighters, as professional soldiers and Marines. You know, we have a lot of tasks that we do, and we rely on our aviation brethren and counterparts to make sure those things happen. And we do have a lot of trust in them to do that. But to describe the reverence and mm-hmm. the care and the brotherhood in which we take care of our fallen warriors, from the point of injury to getting them to Germany and then on to Dover, Delaware, where they're taken to their final resting place with their families, I think was an important piece that just hadn't been told again. And these are small pieces in Echo and Ramadi that I think really are illuminating to not only every reader, but even smaller segments within the military that just didn't know about it. Because I think most have seen Taking Chance with Kevin Bacon. It was a great HBO film that highlights the final movement of a young Marine back to his hometown, and they did a really good job with that. But what happens before they even get to that point is described in detail in that chapter of the book.
I tell you, Scott, that's why I really appreciate it. I think, you know, one of the more touching points of the book too is when you talk about one of the pilots there who would keep a log of every single fallen warrior. He would fly home on an Angel Flight, and at some point he just stopped doing it, I think when he hit 100 names. But very touching. Which brings me to another point. I found it interesting. You went back to visit the family of one of your fallen Marines in their pueblo in New Mexico, I think it was, the members of his tribe. And I found it interesting because you talk about the cultural differences in Iraq, and then you almost get the sense that, you know, here's the big tall Marine walking onto this reservation, and it was almost like, well, you got kind of the same, maybe similar challenges, although they were much more welcoming, I guess. I don't know if you associated that, you know, when you're there at the Pueblo and you realize you have to go out of the house back to the outhouse, out back, if you associated that with what you were seeing in Ramadi.
Well, I think the real lesson, among others in the book, is the understanding of culture. And there's, you know, great experiences that you learn throughout the book about, you know, the leadership and the team building and survival and the culture. And, you know, again, it's that power of human connection, Ben, that it's not until you put yourself out there and you really want to connect and see how other people live that you understand what they've gone through. And to be able to be welcomed into the home and mm-hmm. of the families of one of the Marines that I lost was something that was important to me. And it was, again, just a real honor to be a part of that family. And all of our Gold Star families, we still keep in touch with them. And despite the loss that they suffer, they really do continue to love us so much. And they may have lost their son or daughter, but they gained another 200 sons in their absence, and we're always there for them, and they're always there for us, which is equally as important.
You know, Scott, I guess why that touched such a point with me, growing up, we were missionaries. We spent time working with the Sioux and the Apache and the Navajo. And very often, coming in from the outside, there is a sort of wall there. But once they accept you, they fully embrace you. And that just really touched me about that part of your story there. I've got about 4 minutes, Scott. There's two things I definitely want to cover real quick. Let's start with what I think is the most important in case we run out of time. At the end of the book, you talk about PTS without the D. And you give a very real description of what physically happened to you and some of your struggles. And I think that, or I would guess, did that lead you to start the Save the Brave organization, Scott? Or tell us a little bit about your experience and your organization.
Well, we say post-traumatic stress because we don't view it as a disorder. I mean, if there's any vocation that's a job enhancer or resume builder, it's being in the military and combat or first responders that you're going to experience this, and it's just part of the job. And we have to get rid of that stigma that it's something bad, because, you know, we're now moving into this terms like post-traumatic growth, which you learn from these things and you deal with them. And I didn't start the foundation, Ben. Nick Velez did. He was one of my junior Marines that fought with me in Ramadi, and he understood that there was no pill or vaccine or therapy that was any better than getting guys together that could connect and understand what we had been through under those conditions of war. And that's where the real healing comes from. And there's so many events that, you know, aren't limited to war that cause PTS. And we never say, well, mine is better than your PTS because you were only in a car accident and I was in combat. We don't discriminate, because everybody deals with trauma differently. And we compartmentalize that as Marines and as warfighters to continue to fight and survive on the battlefield, to continue with the mission, and to continue to protect those on our left and right. But how people deal with those pieces of trauma that they put away on a shelf is interesting. And you can't ignore those things, because you are accumulating those pieces of trauma. And I say that it does catch up to you, and it catches up to everybody. And you just have to be aware of it. But the other thing is that it's all right to have those things, and people need to understand that, because being in combat is such a unnatural act that you just have to understand that this is going to be a part of your life and it's never going to go away. But there's this amazing network of people that can relate to you, can understand you, and that can help you heal through some of this, or at least deal with it, because I think that's important. And it's not some Facebook push-up challenge, Ben. We are losing veterans every day. We're losing our brothers, our sisters, our sons and daughters to the effects of post-traumatic stress, because they are still fighting a battle in their mind. And they're not able to unsee some of the most horrific things they've had to do and see in conditions that are created by humans. And it's important that we recognize that and we extend our hands to them and help them and throw them a rope at times if they need it and pull them on board, man, because that's what's needed. And I challenge everyone to, do what you can to help our nation's veterans. It's a very important message. And by buying a copy of the book, again, I do donate a portion of the proceeds to SaveTheBrave.org to help our vets in need.
Okay, Scott, thank you so much for spending your time with us today. Again, folks, visit EchoInRamadi.com. You can hear this podcast and others. Visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Find us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio, or follow us on Twitter, Warrior Radio, T-U-C dot. You got it, at Warrior Radio TUC. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.